Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and onto changes in society and the world. My name is Andy Pullane. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, design leadership coach, educator, and writer. My guest today is Jason Massoot, who many of you may know from IXDA conferences and especially his writing on shaping design. Jason helps people and organizations navigate their uncertain futures and has spent over 20 years working within UX, design, and innovation consulting worlds. He works closely with people and organizations to consider and combine multiple perspectives to challenge their own. With these rich perspectives, he helps people find positive opportunities and clear paths forward, whether developing new products or services, building teams, or finding new direction for their careers. He runs his own coaching, design, and innovation consultancy, Resonant, works as a design partner at Group of Humans, a network of global creative leaders, and he co-hosts monthly events for IXDA London. Jason, welcome to Power of 10.
Thanks so much for having me, Andy.
So the first time we met was Interaction 2011 in Colorado, in Boulder, Colorado. And I think I'd given a talk, or we'd been doing a thing around design to the Power of 10, or this idea, I think I was running the student competition then, and there's quite a lot about, you know, climate change and all those kinds of things and sustainability that the projects were looking at. And we met, I think it was a party or something afterwards. And you said something to me, I'll make the do the polite version of it, which was, fixing climate change or the global financial crisis is not your effing job, as in designers. And I then started to use it in this talk about design to the power of 10, about looking at the sort of scaling up and connectedness of everything, as a slide. And I followed it by this question of whose job is it? Because I think on the, those original slides, David Cameron, who was then the Prime Minister of the UK, he had his whole kind of, I don't know if it was called big government. No, it wasn't called big government. What was it called? Government, you know, trying to get people kind of involved in government. And
big society.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. There was that kind of aspect of it. And I remember Stefan Stagmeister saying to me, you know, it's not, I don't have any particular responsibility as a designer, but I do have a responsibility as a human being, you know, for these things. Well, so whose job is it?
Well, I guess well, my short answer is, it's funny you brought that up. I can't actually remember saying it, but it is the sort of thing I would say have said back then. I think it depends on if it was briefed to you as a designer. I guess that's the tension around whether it's your role as a human to be aware of these things and to do something about it is somewhat separate to your role as a designer to, I always consider designer as answering a brief. And that's me from a kind of professional services perspective, looking at a designer. And often that is not the brief. There might be, that might be the wider context to a brief, but I think too often, maybe in terms of those student challenges, is like going, well, no one's going to ask a student or a kind of a very junior designer to kind of solve that problem, because it's, you know, it's a huge systemic challenge they're going to talk about one particular part of it. But even nowadays, when people are really focusing on climate or more meaningful things, it's really hard because that's such a huge space. So what's your specific angle on it? And I think probably the root of my concern around it at the time, if I'm reflecting back to that conference, was the balance of sort of designer hubris, where, you know, designers felt like they could affect that very, very large change and do it within a short period of time. I think that that was the problem. And I was probably talking to you about service design, and where there was a lot of aspiration to change these really, really big things, whether it's from an airport to World Hunger or whatever.
Yeah.
And just going, no, that's not going to be a project you're going to do in 3 months. It's going to take you a decade.
No, this is true. You know, and there's definitely, you know, we wrote at the end of our book actually about this, that, that there is definitely opportunities, because I think, you know, fundamental, I'm going to defend service design briefly here, but it's the fundamental to service design is a systems way of looking at things. And I think back then, particularly at those UX conferences, you know, I kept hearing UXers say, UX is everything. And but I'm only seeing websites and apps when you present your stuff at conferences. Or maybe sort of Jason Brew showed a kind of, you know, smart, a building with some kind of amazing display built on the side of it. But otherwise, it was very sort of individual touchpoint focused, and it didn't really connect with everything else. And then I think we've come, there is, has, and still is that kind of hubris. And, you know, and some of it is, I think, a, you know, a career pathway thing, which we're going to talk about later, that, you know, when you first start, a lot of people get into design, you know, because they see things and they think, why is that done this way when it could be done that way? There seems to be, this could be done better. I could make people's lives better. That seems to be a fundamental driver of why, you know, a lot of people get into design. And I do see it, you know, I see it in my service design students still now of, I want to tackle this big thing and it's just solvable. Now that the designers are here, everything's going to be much better. And I guess that's why, your comment, you were being provocative at the time, but your comment really kind of resonated with me because I think it is a useful question. But I think then the follow-up of, well, whose is it, is also an important one. And then the question becomes, how can design facilitate that differently, perhaps, to other forms of running projects and things like that? Do you think that's fair?
I totally think it's fair. And I do love service design for trying to bring that wider systemic perspective in. But I do think that way, I guess the early days of service design emergence and popularity growing, that there felt like a lot of naivety around that.
I think there was and probably still is, yeah.
Yeah, but I think people have realized more recently, and I just remember the only service design conference I went to, and Joel Bailey was talking about kind of grit and, the actual effort required to do some of these things was quite considerable, and took a lot of time, and there's a lot of organizational change and facilitation and support. Yeah. And you're having to interact with many different parts of the business in order to kind of do this great customer experience across all these channels.
Yeah, and I think, one of the things I try and teach my students, especially these days, is, if you're going to be frustrated by the fact that there's a lot of resistance to what you're trying to do, it's like being a firefighter complaining that you get burnt and smell of smoke in the evenings. It's just part of that job. And I think part of the craft, if you like, of service design is less to do with, blueprints and journey maps and all that stuff. And it is much more with the blend of organizational change and design, I guess, and how you make that, or not make that happen, but enable it to happen. I've probably become a little bit, I definitely have become less, I don't know if it's naive, but I kind of think probably is less kind of evangelistic about that, because as we see, it is everyone's problem. The thing that I always wanted to try and get across with this idea of, connectedness, and I think I used to find it really hard to find examples or analogies of this, but COVID has been this amazing thing to show how the small is connected to the big, right? Everything from, social distancing and what that means in terms of stuff you can't do anymore, right the way through to global supply chains and all that stuff. And yeah, I mean, it's not a thing that design tackles on its own. And we were talking actually before, because at that conference, Bruce Sterling gave this a brilliant talk. You can still find it online. Just sort of really gave, I kind of felt like he gave a brilliant dressing down of design hubris in the audience, because he kind of set up this, he sort of pulled the rug from under people's feet, because he talked about kind of all this amazing design stuff and things, and he described himself as our victory condition, and then talked about this old lady, I think, trying to kind of operate a faucet, a tap in a hotel, in this sort of highly designed thing, and just had no idea what was going on, and sort of pulled the rug from underneath us. Did you have any other takeaways from his talk?
Mostly about, was it Henry Dreyfuss around kind of design his own death?
Yeah.
That one, I just didn't know that one. So it was just around kind of like, if you run the course of, really kind of designing and controlling everything, you could take it that far, but maybe that was the wrong takeaway. I do remember it being an amazing talk. There were amazing talks, but it had me, that particular conference had me really engaged and really curious, but also really, really frustrated at the same time, partly because of what you were saying. It's like, you're talking about all this great stuff, and then you're talking about screens and interfaces. And it turns out some of those screens and interfaces did ultimately have an impact on some bigger things. But I think interaction design and the IXDA community always struggled with, well, what is interaction design in this context? And sometimes it's been kind of played out into a wider systemic context and service design. And sometimes, often rarely these days, actually talking about user interface design of various sorts.
Yeah, I mean, before we get on to the shaping design stuff, actually, I think, we were talking about, you've been involved in interaction design and UX for 20 years, as have I. Now we're in this umbrella term and world of product design, which is this kind of the big catch-all and, obviously the hot thing as well at the moment, fueling rather overheated market, I would say, in jobs and salaries at the moment. But, you know, I remember a few years before that 2011 Interaction conference, there was one of the information architecture conferences about, you know, what is information architecture? And everyone, there was like a competition to make a video or something, I think, of what information architects do, you know, and then there's Interaction does, and then there's UX and so on. Plus, there's obviously things like, you know, research, design research, UX research underneath and so on. What's your view on where things are at, as if we're going to be sort of two old guys sitting on a porch kind of complaining about the kids on our lawn? We might as well just do it more explicitly. So what's your view on where things are at?
Oh, it's still messy. It's messier than ever. There's just more factions. It's more confusing. And this probably does play into the whole shaping design thing, I think, in a lot of ways, and why I wanted to create the book, because the titles are becoming ever inflated or try to be collapsed and dismissive of the past. So the product design one, let's take that one, it came up again the other day. I studied industrial design, and I was doing alongside product design courses. Most of the people who graduated from my course and went into making physical products would call themselves a product designer, sometimes an industrial designer. So just the term itself, product design, was really dismissive of this whole industry, and a lot of industrial designers got really pissed off of it. That's one thing. On the other hand, I liked it from the point of view of it trying to be a partner to product management and to kind of do more strategic stuff, because the UX thing was getting too confused with just doing interactions and digital interactions and not necessarily considering the business. So maybe more legitimacy to kind of be considering that product thing made some sense. But in reality, most product designers seem to be more from a user interface designers just jumping over UX to do call themselves product designers.
Yeah.
So they miss a lot of the rigor. And certainly information architecture just got lost in all of that. Yeah. It faded away. There's still people talking about it a bit, but they're clinging on. Content strategy is much more popular, probably more similar to IA than anything.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just got really confusing. So what I tell people is going, yes, this title of what you call yourself, interaction designer, product designer, service designer, whatever, shouldn't matter as much as actually the practices and skills that sit underneath that title. Because that's where the real differentiation lies in who you are versus someone else.
Yeah, that leads us nicely on to shaping design, I think. So, you know, a lot of people might well know you actually from the writing you've done on Medium. You've got kind of a couple of different categories, but one is shaping design. You've put up there a lot of things around self-reflection tools and looking at yourself and things that you've, you know, I know you've run these in workshops and stuff. A lot of people I know, and especially this is true of me, write kind of to scratch their own itch or write in order to put their own thoughts in some kind of order. What was the genesis of all of this for you?
Probably around sort of 2005, I joined a company called Oyster Partners, which you may remember from the sort of London Digital Design days. And it kind of became Framfab and eventually yeah. LBI, Digitas, one of these big machines, grows. And we had a fairly large user experience team, and it grew larger with more information architects that came from the Framfab side. And a couple of things happened. One was a few people went to an Adaptive Path conference in Amsterdam and came back with this framework that either Jesse James Garrett or Peter Merholtz or someone had created that had these four kind of quadrants. And my colleague and friend Warren Hutchison started kind of like, you know, using shapes to kind of draw people overlaying this. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So I started using that, and that became what some people call blob mapping or amoeba mapping. But then also I was at a UPA before UXPA event, and someone was talking about like who are we inspired by, who do we look up to in our industry. And at the time, coming from more of a designer background, there was really only sort of people like Jacob Nielsen, and those people were not really designer friendly. Mm. A lot of my colleagues kind of found it really annoying, not necessarily positive, yeah, and very restrictive yeah. in his approach. And as a designer, he wasn't very inspiring to me. So I was like, well, who do I look up to? And I found it really difficult. So I did some investigation research and into, you know, what makes a good user experience person. And I created a poster basically around that. And a lot of the attributes were kind of softer sides of things and team working sides of things, an aspect of strong backbone, creative mindsets, attention to detail, and all sorts of things. They weren't really about the specific craft and practices that the Adaptive Path quadrant had. And anyway, I just kind of started using both those tools, actually, in interviews with my team, and started to develop more and more frameworks over the years, just to kind of help to kind of understand people either in an interview situation or when they were kind of looking at their career development. And I kind of kept it internally a lot, and I occasionally put some of these frameworks in presentations, and people always sort of gravitated towards them. And I guess what happened was a recruitment consultancy got in touch and said, we'd want to do an updated version of this and have these new categories in it. And I worked with them a little bit, and we created a tool called the UX Spectrum. It's an online little tool you can do things on. And it just reignited my interest in it. And I thought, oh, I could do some of these workshops publicly and start to explore this more. And got some good responses, and then decided I would write a Medium article a day around the different tools, and forced myself to do that and pushed it out there, and got lots of really interesting feedback and hearing stories about people using it. So I was like, ah, okay, I need to do something with this and make it more navigable, more easy to process, because it's a nightmare and badly structured, badly written.
And so that's where you're at the moment. How far, I mean, obviously seen the work in progress as you are at the moment. How far away, or dare you not put a date on it?
I don't know, you tell me.
Depends how much work you put into it.
Yeah, true. I want to release it this year. There'll probably be a beta in the next 2-3 months, so hopefully into end of Q1, Q2. But I have a lot of tools ready, refined. I've got an introduction. I'm working through recipes, which are just sort of a way to navigate people to the different tools based on different circumstances. And then there'll be some copy edited and, you know,
There's a lot of sweeping up the parts, I always find, in at the end of a book. It really kind of surprised me how long that took, actually, those bits. But, you know, a Medium article a day is not to be sniffed at either, actually.
That's hard work.
Yeah, that is hard work. Useful, though, to kind of set yourself that habit, because it probably, there were times where you probably thought, oh, I have no idea what I'm going to write about, and something came out. You know, in it, you've got, I mean, the recipes lead to, or there's a whole bunch of templates you've got. I mean, there's a lot of them. They're really great. I mean, I can really imagine using them in my coaching with design leaders, but also, you know, recommending the people I coach using them with their teams. And we sort of talked about this a little bit the other day. You know, a lot of them are around kind of self-reflection and are more of a sort of a qualitative estimation, if you like, or self-estimation of where you are. And what I talked about before is that I've seen things where, you know, there's been some survey that you fill in and there's all this stuff, and then you get the results back and it says something like, you know, you score in the 73rd percentile of self-actualization and stuff. And I kind of seen those reports and think, well, you know, what does that even mean? You know, that is a kind of, how would you rank self-actualization at all, really? And, you know, and put those things in numbers. And the numbers, I think, give a sort of, I apologize to anyone out there who really loves these things, but my sort of experience of this is they can give a bit of a pseudo sort of rigor to them and sense that these things are defined and definite and not always changing. And I really liked the fact that you had used these things, which are much more, what's the kind of shape of me? It's sort of more important than, am I 3 points above my, you know, my peer or something? Is that sort of coming from your sense of instinct about the stuff, or is these things that you emerged in workshops? I got the feeling like a couple of these things were things you fairly quickly initially did say, oh, we could try this out. It's, you know, how did those things develop?
I think most of them were sort of just quickly tried things out and a little bit of iteration. I didn't labour them because I sometimes kind of, you know, being British, self-deprecating and all that, like I kind of talk about them being imperfect visual frameworks, right? And that's partly because often people would want to kind of go, would disagree with the categories and go, but you haven't got this in there, or like, that's a different level of abstraction. I go, you know what? Don't worry about that for the moment. Just going to play with it and you can develop your own after playing with it.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, I did really want to kind of focus on that qualitative experience. I think there's a few things there. One is that the biggest contention I often get, especially within groups, is, you know, how do I make this comparable across multiple people? And I go, you're focusing on the wrong problem there. But actually, it's harder to do unless you define firstly the categories and then define clearer rubrics to do that. And that's a big project. So what I'm suggesting is take these, allow people to self-reflect from their own perspectives, and that's valuable insight in itself. If someone scores themselves really high on a category and someone scores themselves really low on the same category, that in itself is another data point in terms of humility or self-awareness.
Yeah.
And I find that really valuable. So typically, like when doing the blob mapping, which is one of the more famous ones, you know, I used to do this in interviews, and I'll draw my shape just to illustrate how to do it really quickly, to draw this like this. And then someone would draw their shape, and they would sometimes draw a really tiny one. And they would be like really experienced and really good from what I'd seen in their portfolio. Mm. Whereas others who might do really, really large ones, and they were typically very junior. And I just say, well, that's interesting. You know, it's a kind of Dunning-Kruger effect type of a thing, but it's another data point. But the other side of this, which is why I don't like to digitize them too much, is because the actual act of drawing the shape is you're inputting and getting the output at the same time. And so that has a different level of connection with you reflecting than writing it down separately in a form. Some of those forms for those surveys are really painful, I find. Agree, 4, 5, da, 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 oh, it's going to take ages. This is more instant, right? And you get a feeling of it and you go, oh, that felt weird. Oh, I could adjust that. And so I think you have a different dialogue with it. And then any nuance that you have around why you made those markings, you could capture separately or discuss with someone. And often, though, you know, a lot of the other tools don't really enable you to capture that nuance enough.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. You've written actually that, you know, these things are better done physically than digital. Well, I don't know if it's digitally or remotely. I mean, now we're, of course, we're in a remote.
It's more spatially. World. Like, what do I mean by that? Because I've got some templates I've put into Procreate on my iPad. Yeah. And it's similar of experience, right?
Okay.
But when you draw it in like PowerPoint, I've had to make PowerPoint template versions. You're kind of doing the nodes and moving them around and pulling. It's a bit different to just drawing a shape.
Right. Okay. So it's the sort of free. It's the you free all through form. This. Obviously, people can't see this, but you've been making this kind of drawing arc sign with your hand. That connection to the physical act of moving your hand around is the important bit. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Have you done any of these where, you know, someone has done their self-reflection of themselves and then someone else who knows them or works with them does, you know, their version of that person? So you can kind of compare how other people perceive you to yourself.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting thing to do. In fact, when I did the Creating the Perfect Experience Architect poster, I would do one self-reflection, one reflection from a peer within your discipline, one reflection from a project manager, one reflection from a client.
Yeah.
And the idea is that you would then sort of, you know, triangulate. And then there's an interesting discussion to be had there, because some people will observe your behavior in your actual and can compare it against other people they've worked with. And then you can kind of do it based on everything that you know about yourself, which might be more extensive, but less comparable.
You know what? It's one of the things I get to do, like kind of lightweight 360 feedback when I start coaching with people, and one of them is sort of an internal self-reflection thing, but the other one is that. And the thing that constantly fascinates me, because it comes up like not all the time but often enough to be a thing, which is that often the thing that people think is their greatest weakness is what other people think is their greatest strength in the feedback. And I kind of really fascinated by this idea of, so my wife's a Jungian psychoanalyst, and Jung had this concept of the shadow, you know, and it wasn't always kind of bad stuff, but this idea that any skill you have, something you're quite good at, has a kind of shadow side when it over indexes. So some, you know, classically, someone who's quite orderly and kind of has this sort of act together and organized can be really, really pedantic when they get stressed, and it usually comes out in stress times. And it's fascinating to see how that maps together. That's why I was asking, because I think that would be kind of really interesting thing to see those overlaid.
I think that's really super interesting in terms of, we were talking last week around the different personas and personalities you might have depending on how you're showing up. So say something like Myers-Briggs, which I know you were, a lot of people as well have concerns with, but it's like, you know, when you answer some of those questionnaires and different surveys, you know, I have to kind of look at it from a particular context of how I'm showing up. And you know, and this comes back to authentic leadership and, you know, phrases like that, but because I don't think I'd be a very good leader if I was authentically me, because I'm constantly divergent, lateral, you know, maybe mode, very much emergent and flowing. And I had to kind of impose a lot of structure and extroversion into my personality and stuff. I felt like I had to in order to be successful. And now I'm just kind of caught between those two things quite a lot. And I think it's super interesting, because I was chatting to someone else, you know, recently about being diagnosed with ADHD, and he was naturally kind of imposing lots of interesting structure and order on his work and made him really efficient. Everyone thought he was like a productivity machine almost. And actually it's because he was working on that area that he did, wasn't feeling confident in. Yeah. And I was like, God, that's so much like me. So I was just like, So I didn't realize it was in, it was related to Jungian shadows and stuff as well. That's super interesting.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, Jung, Myers-Briggs is based on those sort of Jungian, you know, personality types as well, and sort of extroversion, introversion, and then thinking, feeling, sensation, and the other one, which I've now, intuition. But there's a richness and depth in there that I think can get overlooked. And one of the things I guess I see sometimes when people go through those very sort of structured, you know, whatever it is, surveys and assessments, is this sort of self-identification thing where people go, well, I'm a, you know, I'm a this kind of person, or I'm this kind of personality type, and therefore that's why X, Y, and Z. Sometimes it can be useful for people, I think, where it explains why people struggle with something. It's what you can call sort of inferior function, which isn't like bad. It's just that this is the your weak spot, right? So my sort of inferior function might be, as a British person, extroverted feeling. I'm not someone who kind of emotes very strongly, you know, which can mean that, you know, when it's going, things are going well, that can mean I'm quite stable in sort of difficult situations. On the other hand, it also can mean I'm sort of monotone in my emotional responses, which isn't so great sometimes in a relationship, you know, and so they all have, you know, you can be moved around in those things. You know, to say, well, I am a, you know, ENF, whatever, I can't remember the Myers-Briggs thing, and that's me, and therefore that defines me who I am, feels back to front, right? And yeah, also ignores this idea of you know, of growth, that you can change, on, yes, and mindsets that you change regarding, depending on the context you're in.
Mm-hmm. Too, right? Mm, I think the change aspect is really interesting. But then I think, in defense of it to some extent, I think... these are all just different sort of frameworks and lenses to look at yourself. And this is why I have so many different tools, because some tools will expose different differences to people than others. And I think like in certain strategy work, you know, lots of different frameworks I might apply to a problem to see the gaps and the strengths in different ways. My thing is around actually having diversity and a range of different tools to throw on the problem and yourself, because the nuances might be very different. And the you know, the Myers-Briggs things give you a framework. The problem, I think, is if you just limit yourself to one, when that one doesn't really help and serve you as well. It might for some, it might for others. But I do think that what it does is, you know, as we pattern match the world, like, you know, rather than deal with the infinite nuances and differences between us, by having some shared frames of reference, it does help a little bit for some people. I just think that if you try to kind of like exhaustively cover humanity and everyone's differences with those, you're obviously going to be caught out.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's also this thing that the map is not the territory, right? So yeah. I think that there's a thing you said before that reminded me. I've just finished up a set of training that I've been doing for a client, and, you know, in service design and things, and one of the things that came up in the discussion at the end, which I was really pleased to hear, was these tools like blueprinting and a few other things we were doing have helped us think around things or fire off kind of different sort of neurons than we would normally have. And this idea that the discussion you're having in front of doing those things, you know, I'm saying in front of it as if those were on a wall or on a mural now or a mirror, but, you know, those discussions you're having whilst you're making those things with each other are kind of the work, right? They're more important than the actual artifact themselves. And I think this sounds like what you're saying with these tools, that the act of reflection that you're going through whilst you're filling in the tool is sort of more important than the final shape of the map that you're
absolutely
going, you know, yeah.
And that's the thing where people get it wrong with my stuff, and certainly in terms of, you know, my new experiences as a coach as well, where it's all about the discussion around it and exploring that side. All the tools are a sort of an initial prop or stimulus, right? And an artifact that you, like you say, like a boundary object or whatever, that brings people together and has that shared view on a plate that you can say, object, here's a thing. What does that mean for us? And it's just easy to talk around as humans, I think. And like in, you know, in terms of research, you know, even when doing generative research, I always find it useful to put a prop in front of someone. Yeah, it might be a card, it might be a prototype, it might be, I don't know, a picture, but it's going to provoke different things and stimulate a different reaction. Like in a similar way to, you know, a strength scope or a strength finder or whatever those tools are going to give, or even like a tarot card, maybe even as well. You're going to have your own associations and leap off in different ways of what that might mean to you. It's just prodding and poking. And so I think that it does help, like a good question might help.
You've just given me an idea for design tarot cards. now.
Well, yeah, maybe speak to Tutti around that. I found some other ones recently, which was around the tarot cards of tech. Oh yeah, that was
hang on, yeah. Tarot cards of tech. Oh, there are some. Okay.
Yeah, there's like I think it was from Artifact Studio. I think they did it. They had it. I think they shared it at one of the maybe in Seattle Interaction Conference. And yeah, I haven't looked at it in a while, but I found it because I was doing a tarot session the other day with someone.
But I think there's a thing there also that is quite interesting. I think it's always interesting from a sort of leadership position, particularly in terms of a culture of feedback, which is having a third thing. You know, having an artifact is really crucial. I think John Colco talks about this, and so does someone whose name I've forgotten for a second. This idea of we're not going to have a discussion about your work unless there's an artifact there that we can talk to. It turns it from being a kind of face-to-face confrontation about this is all about you to a let's look at this third thing side by side together and have a conversation about what this means is a really nice way of working with people and giving feedback, particularly if there's a power structure already sort of embedded in, you know, as your, I'm your boss or whatever. And then you can have a conversation about what was your intention here?
Yes.
And then I'm not really getting that from this. Is not like you've done this wrong, but given your intention, it's not quite working. Let's have a look at it. It's and I think there's something around those kinds of objects as well that you're talking about where you have the third thing. Engenders a different kind of conversation. My experience has been that's also been true of, you know, managing stakeholders and all that kind of stuff too.
I think so. That makes a lot of sense, actually. I love that notion of the third thing. I think because it somewhat neutralizes it. It takes a little bit more of the emotion out of it to some extent. My friend Andrea Mignolo talks about that when doing feedback, this notion of a shared plate, and you're presenting information, but you're kind of presenting it, looking at it on the plate necessarily. It's not in you, it's not in me, it's between us. And I like that notion of that third thing where it's on the plate and it's just like, it's there. This is a representation articulated. It's going, oh, and it'd be great if you had yours and then we could look at them together and depersonalize them a little bit. Even though it's a representation of you, it's not something that can't change and whatever. But when it's in you, it just gets wrapped up in all of these other things, these other emotions and self-talk and all that.
I think it's an underappreciated, I know it's kind of, I'm going to sort of make it sound like design as a snowflake, which you actually use that metaphor, but in the sense of everyone's unique. But, you know, I think it's underestimated the act of kind of every day of, sort of birthing something, if you like, or pulling something out of yourself, that even if it is to a brief, there is still a thing of, I've made a thing and I'm exposing it to you for critique or to be kicked to pieces. And that's quite a hard, that sort of resilience to that. I was going to say a thick skin, but I don't think it's quite so much that. I think it's much more of a, you know, there's this famous haiku, you know, mythology that the haiku masters, when they wrote what they thought was their best haiku, they would sort of put it in a bottle and throw it in the ocean or something, you know, and so no, in order to practice non-attachment. I think it's more around that. So yes, I've made a thing and I've put it out there in the world, but it's not a piece of me. That takes some time, I think.
Yes. God. I mean, there's a lot around that. I think, you know, certainly for the points of view of critique and able to, you know, depersonalize your own attachment to it, and I think, and I believe, and you know, I want, and all those kind of phrases versus it is here, it's what it's based on. But I have a tension with that one because in some parts I see designer as a kind of neutral facilitator and all those sorts of things and gathering up the inputs and whatever. But also, I strongly believe in the power of the designer's own ego and passion and interest, kind of helping and experience, kind of.
Yeah.
Putting themselves in it, not so much like as in art, but I do think it's important because you're not going to take two or three different designers and give them the same problem and they're going to end up with the same solution. I do think there is always a little bit of them in it. It's just maybe that they have to try to find ways to depersonalize it so they can kind of take on the feedback and go, you know what, that is an interesting perspective, and not take it as a personal attack. But I think the part of the problem and what's happened in design more recently, and certainly in user experience and maybe digital product design, is that we've depersonalized and devalued the human designer in the process. So I get it can be dangerous and emotionally attachment is risky for kind of, you know, actually getting the feedback. But I also think it's a powerful thing that we're losing a little bit of.
I think so too. I mean, I talked about this in a talk once about this balance of ego and humility that you need to have. And it could, because you do need to be able to box things through. You do need to be able to stand up for something different And there's a certain amount of ego in that, because you need to be able to kind of push it forward. And not all ego is bad. If you have none, it's awful, actually. You know, and as a child develops, part of the thing of them developing their ego is a really crucial part. And if they don't, it causes lots of problems. Or if they don't have a kind of strong sense of self, it causes lots of problems later on. But at the same time, the humility to, you know, on the basis of new feedback, evidence, whatever it is, to be able to kind of step back and understand, well, this isn't all about me, and this isn't just what I say goes, you know. And you and I have been through that era of, I guess it's the 90s mostly, and some of the early noughties of the star designer, you know, which seems to have sort of gone away, actually.
Yeah, I miss it. I miss parts of it, because like, you know, back to the doing that poster, it was like there wasn't anyone in this industry really easily to look up to. I could look up to industrial designers or graphic designers. And if you go to a kind of industrial design or furniture design conference, it's all about the work, less about the theory. It's interesting, but like, you know, it's a big show, but it's very impressive. But yeah, I think we just need to kind of get that back in balance. I once did a really a talk. It wasn't one of my best, but it was called Ego versus Empathy. Nice, but a similar thing. But I like ego versus humility. But it was just trying to put those things in tension, saying, look, you know, you need a little bit of both, and just consciously where you're going to bring it in.
You know, you talked about soft skills in your book as well, and I saw a comment in there, because you've, you know, asked a few people to comment on it, feeling a bit sort of finding that term difficult, which I do too, because I think soft skills are the hardest, actually. And so I struggle with the term, but obviously it's a thing that everyone knows what it means. You know, a lot of what we've been talking about is also, how do you approach design leadership? And you were talking about, you know, I've had to do all these things. What does it mean for you?
I don't know. I think it's changed. My perception of it's changed. Like, from one perspective, it was kind of standing up at the front and this, you know, kind of inspiring people and giving them the clarity and the vision. And I think we've lost that over the recent years. Mm. But on the other side, there was an aspect of, you know, the people manager side and kind of being more of the coach, right? And I recognize through going through coaching training, I was going, oh, this would have been useful for me as a manager. And also is kind of a looser rein thing, you know, how you can support and nurture and kind of get the best out of others around you without, you know, just going, this is the way. So I don't know. I think that there's a need for a little bit of both. And actually, you know, one of the tools I use, a leadership profile, it's very much around kind of where you lean towards. Are you the one kind of being the articulate advocate, selling, being out there in all the communities? Or often people kind of sway more towards the people side of things, or the specific practices and structure. I was a big fan of the Leading Design Conference, and went to most of the early ones. And there was a lot of kind of vulnerability and sharing, because people were feeling lonely. As you go into leadership, or as you go into independent consulting, you get lonely because you can't interact with anyone at the same level. But then there was a lack of actual like vision work, like actual strategic vision and clarity and possibility of the future. So I don't know. I think that there is a tension there, because, you know, some people go into that design leadership and go, you know what, I want to get back to making stuff. I love making stuff.
Yeah.
And I certainly have that tension. I do. I like the people. I love the people work. I love doing coaching. I love the mentoring. I love working with teams. But I also like, you know, helping craft and create the future with people and be that more visionary side. So it's an interesting tension for me, at least, anyway.
I also think, you know, there's no shame in someone who takes that step into leadership, which does often mean giving up actually doing their craft, practicing their craft, more or less, you know, a couple of years in, going, do you know what, I really miss this isn't for me. Absolutely. and stepping back. And I you know, I was gonna say stepping down then. I don't really want it to sound like that, because my point is just, I think it's fine. I think the most important thing is for people to say, you know, this isn't really for me. I've seen the opposite thing, where people have realized, hey, you know, I the team and the company and the organization and the culture, those are my new materials, and what I'm designing is that stuff now, and thrive. But I really do think people have to find their own, you know, where they thrive in those things, because there's nothing worse than having a leader who kind of hates being a leader. Right?
Yeah, and I think that happens quite a lot. And, you know, some people have been asking me, is like going, I don't know if I'm ready for this, and, you know, to go into these roles. And I think, well, it's good that you were asking those questions and reflecting on that. But to some extent, you won't necessarily know until you try. So I ended up in it, and I got promoted when I was a craft delivery person. And I started to love it. I really started to love it, until the point when I just got sick of hiring, sick of just doing that, and sick of the team kind of going, Jason, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't do the work anymore. And I was like, oh, like punch to the gut. And so, you know, I kind of went and I took a different part into, you know, that's when I went to join Plan and focus on product strategy and just go deeper into the strategic side of things. But I do think that actually you might change your focus, right? And you build up this repertoire and palette. It doesn't mean necessarily you lose all that stuff in the past. I mean, you might find it harder to kind of use Figma again or whatever the new tool is. But, you know, you might value some of the organizational side of things, the processes there. You might value the people management stuff and you might try different things out for different periods of your life. And that's okay. In our culture, it seems at the moment that people want to pigeonhole you and you have to be one specific type of thing. It's very much a kind of like a branded approach. You know, you are the only one that does this. And I kind of push against that a little bit. I think it's okay to have a few different interests. They can all kind of coexist and maybe some come into the foreground more.
I think it's important. It's an illusion to think that you are just one of those things. And for me, I think that's what the great resignation or reshuffle, as I've recently heard it, is largely about, which is when people suddenly hit pause and were either at home not working or at home working, and their personal life and their work life was blended together, it became much clearer, I think, to a lot of people that, oh, I'm actually all of these things at once. You know? And it's a thing I used to say about smartphones, it's you know, about thinking about customers and users and stuff, is obviously, you know, when I used to commute to an office, along the way, I'm a husband, I'm a father, you know, I'm a social media curator or something, you know, putting something, writing something, putting out there. You know, I'm also doing my professional work. You know, you switch personas just by virtue of the fact it's like an app, right? Mm-hmm. From one app to the next, I'm switching who I am and what I'm being. And you've got all these multiple sides to you and they don't just go away. It's not like you kind of, there's a sort of locker at the door when you go into the office and you put all of that stuff away and there's just only a bit of you walks in. And in fact, people who do try to do that, I think you see this, the consequences of it, because there's a lot of acting out and pent up sort of frustration and anger and all sorts of things that doesn't get spoken about in work that then causes grief for all sorts of people. I'm going to spring this on you because I didn't tell you in advance, which is the last question of Power of Ten is named after that famous Eames film of, you know, the relative size of things in the universe.
Love it.
Which is the last question is, which one small thing, and it could be something overlooked or underrated, has a outsized effect on the world, or would have if it was redesigned?
Text entry on a mobile device.
Explain that.
So, as much as like smartphones and touchscreen technology is really powerful and has enabled so much we can do with these things, just so many trip ups and kind of accidental, it's, I suppose, not just text entry, it's like hitting return, send quicker enough. It probably causes a lot of pain, a lot of misunderstanding. But, you know, I don't want to be kind of all classical and, you know, go back to the days of the BlackBerry, but it was a really efficient, useful device I could do without typing and whatever. And we just deluded ourselves with the touchscreen being better for some of these things. So just from a very micro interaction perspective, it's getting better, but it's still rubbish. It's still terrible and causes me so much pain and so much frustration and embarrassment, and many, many other people too. I mean, there's whole sorts of memes around it. So yeah, that's one thing that I think, yeah, people are working.
Have you read, what's that? There's a website about autocorrect. Damn you, autocorrect,
yes, or something. Yes, yeah, exactly.
There's lots of very rude ones. They're very funny. Have you read the book Creative Selection by Ken Kosciender?
I have not.
So he's the guy who basically developed autocorrect for Apple. And there's this whole story of how, you know, the iPhone was, all the prototypes and stuff were, you know, going pretty well, but the keyboards just, it was just rubbish. No one could type anything. And so it was where they stopped all the teams working on anything else and said, okay, everyone's just going to work on keyboards for now. And there was like this sort of creative selection that went on. The thing that fascinated me about it is that he worked with this guy, I don't know his surname, I can't remember, but he worked with this sort of interaction designer called Bass, somebody, who did all the demos in Macro, what's now Adobe Director.
No way.
And, you know, he worked out, he had this sort of idea of, you know, well, surely if you know roughly the letters next to each other, if I bring in the dictionary and you can kind of guess which one it's most likely to be. It's a really, really fascinating read. It's sort of a fascinating read of, for that sort of culture at Apple, of the art of the demo, right? So he's particular about not calling it a prototype. He's like, you have to make a thing that sort of works as if it was the real thing.
Yes.
It's not a prototype. It's a demo to show. And that's the thing that sort of went up to Steve Jobs to then kind of decide. If you had an idea about something, you had to kind of build a demo of it. Mm. And it's good. It's good.
I mean, it's amazing technology that was in that and has been continued to be developed, a lot of the sort of drift kind of tolerance and all those sorts of things. But you know, and it had to be passable for it to be convincing as a, you know, to get people off their handsets and stuff. I'm just suggesting that it's still got a long way to go and still problematic and causes a lot of pain in the world. I'm not saying people aren't working tirelessly on it. It's important.
You'll love it from an interaction point of view. There's lots of details there about, you know, the bit where they recognize that, oh, hang on, but when you're typing, your thumb covers the letter and so you can't tell whether you're typed or not. So we'll make it bigger. We'll make it zoom up, you know, as you tap on it. All sorts of things. Lots and lots of tiny things, which if you've ever had something malfunctioning on one of those things. I had an app the other day and autocorrect wasn't, I don't know, it's like it built its own interface or something. So autocorrect wasn't kicking in.
Okay.
And it was just awful. I couldn't tell. You forget how much you...
Or if it's a little bit wet or something. And
all of those things. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the bigger problem, Mark, too. Cold weather. You can tell it's designed by people in California. Jason, thank you so much for being my guest. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
Medium.com/Jason Masoot and medium.com/shapingdesign for, the Shaping Design series. Catch me on LinkedIn. I'm the only Jason Masoot in the world, I think, so that's easy. And sometimes on Twitter, but less so these days.
And it's spelled M-E suit, as S-U-I-T.
No, no I, so it's just a weird thing. So it's M-E...
Oh, there's no I?
Yeah, M-E-S-U-T, me sut.
M-E-S-U-T, ah, okay. Right.
That's why everyone gets it wrong.
My notes as well, yeah. Okay.
There we go.
Thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
Thank you.
As I'm sure you're aware, you've been listening to Power of 10. My name is Andy Pullane. You can find me at apullane on Twitter, or Pullane.com, where you can find more episodes and sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you like the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. It really helps others find us. And as always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.